This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Mila Kaslansky.
And we're your hosts for Art Moves. Today, we'll be talking with the program officer at the Lambent Foundation, Rasu Jilani. Rasu is a self-described cultural network curator and social sculptor, is a very informed voice on what is happening in art and community development. He'll share his insights and perspective on this episode of Art Moves. So Rasu, tell us what all of that means.
You know, when you have a hell of an editor, they can take all your loquacious words and put it into some type of poetics.
Exactly.
But, you know, essentially what my practice is, I am a community organizer that also works in community development, art, culture, network builder, you know. So network building has followed me through my whole career, whether it was in technology, law, art, culture, community organizing. It's like, how do you build networks around a particular movement, specifically that is situated with values, situated with a common vision and goal? Where folks know their roles and know their positionality in order to get a job done or get a vision executed. So that looks like a plethora of ways that can manifest, right? So in art, oftentimes what it is like working with collectives, working with art and cultural institutions. It may be something as simple as like developing an audience engagement plan. You know, it may be something as simple as, you know, coming up with a theater cultural strategy for a theater company or production company. You know, also, you know, more recently when I met Eli is working at New Ink, where I had to build a community, you know, of artists, designers, and technologists. So that is building a network, a generative network that can actually see each other, can share resources and ideas, you know. So this is something that you can't go to college to learn. This is something that becomes an innate tinge that you have to tap into all the resources and all the skill sets you have. But it took me a while to get there.
It's a way of thinking, though,
it
right?
It is a way of thinking.
Mean, that's what I see. This is how you see the world so that you can make these connections, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. It's also a way of being, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not just thinking.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, you mentioned New Ink. Could you talk a little bit about it? I'm not sure everyone knows what that is.
Sure. So New Ink is the world's first museum-led incubator. It is based out of the New Museum. It was founded by Lisa Phillips, Karen Wong, and the first executive director was Julia Kangansky, who hired me to move on to Stephanie Pereira, who was the second director of New Ink. And New Ink is a space, an incubator, truly an incubator, not an accelerator, not a co-working space. They have co-working space mm-hmm. elements. But basically, if you have a creative idea, you have a project that needs to get off the ground, the incubator allows you to experiment radically. It allows you to gather your resources. It allows you to get mentorship. It allows you to get some advice. Imagine like most of these startups have like advisory boards, you know. Even, you know, we're here in Brick, they have a board, right? Mm-hmm. But imagine if you're a startup, a one-person startup, and you have your own board of directors. You know, New Ink creates a structure where you have folks who can actually feed the water the seed, right? And, you know, failure, we can't escape from that because we do have failures in these incubators,
right?
You can fail forward. Mm-hmm. It's called iteration. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, essentially what New Ink allows you to do is to really get all of that energy out within a year or 2 years to see what's possible and then grow from there. And then you can go wherever you need to go with
that.
Can
you give an example of a project?
How about the miniature museum?
Oh, the micro museum. That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Thank you. That's a good one. Micro museum. So micro museum was started by Amanda Sackett and what is Charles's last name? I can't remember his last name. But nevertheless, they started a museum because what they were thinking about was how can we engage everyday folks with science, mm-hmm. right? Literally science. Like they had the smallest museum. They had a museum around perpetual motion and bringing science in a very digestible, microscopic way. So in the museum, it's literally like this construct that can go in any alley, any corridor, any gallery or whatever. And it's not very big. It's a lot is packed into it. And basically, they're using design in order for you to understand the nuances of any scientific idea. So in this case, the Smallest Museum, they were breaking down what is a mollusk, octopuses and squids and so on, and how they're aliens of our planet, right? And
well, that's what they say. Do you believe that? Do you believe that?
I personally, I'm a weirdo, so I believe in all types of crazy ideas.
I do too. I believe in all types of things. Past lives, the whole bit. I'm right there.
Right. So they use this museum structure, the ideas of a museum compacted, mobilized, right? And they've grown tremendously. They've been able to raise $2 million. They've been able to expand their staff. They've been able to, I think they're working out of New Lab now, where they have a desk, and they also have a structure where they're manufacturing these museums. So every quarter, I think every half a year to a quarter, they're constructing new museums.
Yeah, they lease them out. They lease them out to malls. They're about 3 foot square or so, and about 6 or so high.
Right. And a project like that, you wouldn't find Y Combinator or TechStars, right? So like I was, because I'm no longer there, but we were that space that you bring your radical, weird idea, right?
Mostly from creatives, though. It's not like
from creatives, from designers, technologists, and artists, and
so it's not like MIT, science, computer scientists by himself, or
And we had some computer scientists.
No, I understand,
but that's what makes it unique.
It's a home for creative, and it's interesting because a lot of art schools don't have technology transfer programs. Right. And they should, so that's in some ways that's what that is.
But Eli was a mentor there. That's why he knows so much.
I was a super mentor.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Oh, okay. Yes. So, but you have some interesting titles here, like Social Sculptor. You talk about, which is kind of curious.
What is that?
I co-opted that from Jonathan Baez.
What is a social sculptor? Yeah. I want to know.
There's a few of us out there. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a few of us out there. I think about Ebony Golden. I think about Rick Lowe and Houston for Project Row Houses.
Do you go to school for that?
No. I mean, it's another thing I don't think you go to school for.
No, you can't.
I think about someone like Shayna Griffin in New Orleans. Like they may not use the title. I just use that title, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of my social practice, community organizing, cultural producing, so on and so forth. So a social sculptor, in the way that is defined, Jonathan Baez was a German artist who would use his platform to really tackle very complex political and social ideas, right? He was actually, at some point, even to a degree, considered like an enemy of the state because he was really pushing some ideas. And I was really inspired by watching us, reading and watching some old stuff and just being like, okay, this is what this is. What would that look like now, right? What would Einstein or what would, Shakespeare write about now? It would be the issues of this time. So if I want to tackle, and in my hearts of hearts, I am motivated by social issues. I'm motivated by justice. So how can I galvanize using my, networks and using my talents for curation to bring all people together? So sculpting the social environment for which these ideas can germinate.
I love being motivated by justice. Mm. Now, I'm going to go back a little bit in time and talk a little bit about Yusef Hawkins. Apparently, that was a pivotal moment in your life. Can you elaborate?
Yeah. Yusef Hawkins happened, I think it was either 89, 90. And I was a kid.
Yeah. I was new to New York City.
Yeah. I was like 11 or 12 or someone like that. And, when that happened, it happened in Bensonhurst, and he was attacked by a crowd for being in the wrong neighborhood. And really what it did was really put in perspective how race is a delicate subject. However, it's so pervasive, rage, race, racism, patriarchy, colonial expression. And as a youth, although I grew up in a predominantly Black neighborhood in South Jamaica, Queens, when I saw that, it interrupted my perspective of life. It was like, oh, I have to be careful. I have to be careful when I show up in a place and I may look different just by skin color, that it may incite a rage in someone. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily my problem. But the fact is I have to be on my P's and Q's. And it shifted me. It shifted me to be very cautious, right? It shifted me on being very mindful of my space. When I'm in a space, what it does.
And the skin you're in too, man. Right.
Sure. And I would even say beyond skin, because now, accelerated, 30 years later, 30 years later, I'm very mindful of my maleness in spaces, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because that is something we're shifting to more of a feminine energy and consciousness. So I'm very conscious of the space that I take.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
We're listening to the evocative Rasu Jalani about being a self-described cultural curator.
Could you speak more about being conscious of feminine energy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to hear about exactly what you mean about that.
I'm going to do that. I'm also going to connect and finish my thought on Yusuf Hawkins as well.
Okay, but yes.
So the feminine, we had a patriarchal systems, mm-hmm. multiple systems that is predicated on imperialism, colonialism, mm-hmm. and so on, right? And as a male person, a male identified, a male bodied, my consciousness, all of that is male, right? So I'm understanding that about myself and how much privilege comes with being a male-bodied person, right? Like being able to walk the streets and have a different worries than women would have, right? I grew up in a house full of women, so I'm tapped in and conscious constantly of what some of the things that women worry about, but I can't pose to be someone who knows the mind of a woman, right? Only things that were communicated to me. So as we're moving on and we're becoming more of aware of ourselves as a society, we're starting to point out and name the structures that have been very damaging to the advancement of the collectivity of humanity.
Yeah, you hear misogyny, right? A lot. That's like the new word.
But all of that is mm-hmm. part of it, right? Mm-hmm. And some of it is heavy-handed, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Some of it is a little tricky. Some of it is gray, sure. But the structure in itself needs to be examined and needs to be dismantled. And quite frankly, we all need to dismantle it within ourselves.
So that's where it starts.
That's the number one. That's the only thing you have
control
of.
Hearts and minds.
That's the only thing you have control of. So going back to Yusuf Hawkins, it triggered, right? Be mindful of your space. Mm-hmm. Also, as a New Yorker, we're always mindful. Our eyes are shifty and making sure who's walking in and out of things and stuff like that. You know, so it triggered that, but it also triggered a seed. And damn, this kid was a couple of years older than me. Like, that could have happened to me, right? So that consciousness of being empathetically connected to someone else kind of seeded my justice practice.
It's interesting that there are also, it also makes sense too, why there's such effort now to suppress any conversations about looking at the structure. You know, I think there's a power to doing that. And mm-hmm. there's a great fear to that.
Yeah. I mean, the fear is because you might have to take, you might have to dismantle the whole thing. And nobody really wants to do that, right? Even the folks, this is my assertion, even the folks that are bucking up against the system may have a bit of attachment and codependency to the system that they're up against.
Codependency.
Right? So as we're thinking about that, including myself, right? So how do we contemplate and dismantle the system within ourselves? How do we actually address that? How do we see ourselves in the issue that we're identifying? And this is what I mean by critical consciousness now, right? Critical consciousness meaning not just being conscious and aware, but how can I be aware and conscious and then examine myself within that consciousness? It's a Buddhist practice for sure. It's a practice that's in Sufism. It's a practice in many different cultural phenomenon, but one of the things I'm saying is like we can't fling around the word conscious without being critical.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's why I say it's a question of being too, because there's a requirement for being present to things, right? And also mm-hmm. accountable, of course. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think we'd like to also shift the conversation a little bit. Of course, you also found some interesting thing. This coup d'état arts a while back.
Is this y'all went way into my
history.
Resume. Jesus.
Yeah, we wikied you up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they called the internet, you know.
Yeah, coup d'etat was a tremendous moment in my life. Very proud of coup d'etat. Coup d'etat was founded by me and my brother, Daoud Abaid. And we're two kids from New York City who were, you know, what people may call nowadays hype beast. But, you know, we were really into the sneaker and t-shirt culture. We knew all the folks that had the stores in Soho and Brooklyn. And we were part of the culture. But we were interrupted by the culture because we saw how much appropriation of Black culture and brown culture was taken on mm-hmm. by a bunch of folks who weren't part of that culture, but making a ton of money from it. Mm-hmm. Right. So we were of the culture and by the culture and, you know, stewards of it. And we wanted to overthrow some of the lowbrow aspects of the culture that we needed to really address. So coup d'etat became an overthrow of notions of the culture that we really didn't like, but it was also an examination of ourselves, right? We were questioning, what do we really like? What do we really like about this brand? Why do we invest in this, right? And that came out into graphical expressions to our t-shirts that went on to go into like, you know, different forms of clothing. And then that manifested into, because I started to have this spark that I was interested in art and culture. Mm-hmm. It was less about the fashion. It was more about the movement building. It was more about, we had a movement at one point, right? So it was like growing that, and that turned into a collective of artists that started my career around like 2006, 2007, and integrating that with Afropunk.
I'm still kind of stuck on critical consciousness. How do you move folks along in terms of their thinking? Because I know I will be in meetings that are somewhat male-dominated, and if we're having a discussion that's a little heated, it's like I don't get a chance to express myself. Mm-hmm. You know, Tony, you know, and yeah. I would like to just not just look at you, but say what it is I have mm-hmm. to say. I really am interested in hearing you're a male and you're talking about feminism, and how are you pivoting and adjusting? Because so much of this is just an embedded way of being mm-hmm. and thinking. It's mm-hmm. all embedded. It's subconscious.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. It's listening more. Right. It's just like really like going into a situation. I'm very comfortable in a room full of women that is not in a dynamic that is predicated on sex, that's not predicated on dominance or having my own voice heard. You know, it's going into a room is like, OK, these are perspectives that are probably going to really challenge me. You know, it's perspectives, it's an opportunity to listen, and it's an opportunity to see what's emerging within a community that I'm not in, like, immediately attached to. So I think that's one. Two, there has to be a willingness for change, right? Not for bottom line, right? Like you watch during the Black Lives Matter movement, we're going to literally call last year Black Lives Matter, outside of COVID, the Black Lives Matter era, right?
Yes. Racial reckoning.
Right. At least the real like groundswell of it, mm-hmm. right? All the institutions that were rushing, all the brands that were rushing to do something Black Lives Matter-ish, right? Like even cafes that would look at me sideways when I walked in mm-hmm. has Black Lives Matter outside. So it becomes kind of empty calories after a while. You're like, oh, this is interesting, mm-hmm. right? So my question is like, okay, so how are you actually going to use your platform, use your privilege, use your power to shift things? What are you actively doing? Right. How do you know, you may have to do something hard like re-examine, you know, your board, re-examine where your money comes from. You know, that's both for profit, nonprofit. Right. So when we think about critical consciousness, it's like if you're the awareness, you're conscious of something. Now, what is the critical thing, act or reimagining that's happening in that consciousness? Right. So you can't make anyone think anything. You can only hope to inspire or motivate.
Absolutely.
You have this innate ability to have these, not just epiphanies, but also recognition of certain tipping points, mm-hmm. and then be able to translate it into something that impacts community, mm-hmm. right? Which kind of leads me to the work you're doing now, which is the mm-hmm. Lambin Foundation. Mm-hmm. The quote is from the website, and it'd be great to hear you comment about mm-hmm. it, that art can serve as a catalyst, what Kenyan author Ivan, I'll pronounce it right, Ohehambi Owora, I think that's right, calls the ethical imagination the creative act that engages real-world concerns that are considered and of consequence. So what does that mean to you?
Huh. Yeah, I really went into the website. Okay, cool.
we just did our homework.
Right, yes, it's on the test. Yes, it goes to your grade. Yes,
yeah. And so that quote was really a quote that our executive director, that really moved our executive director, Michelle Coffey. We're a philanthropic organization, a donor advisory philanthropic organization, very specific, that really looks at art justice as a catalyst for change, right? So like looking at art and justice and practice, right? Like you can easily fund like a project. Like I need to do this project and it needs to be set up in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. We need funding, boom, fund that. But really what we're considering is like, what is the organizational practice, like how consistent it is, how much it permeates through the board to the staff. And it doesn't mean that all the organizations we fund are perfect, but they're striving for a justice practice that is pervasive in their organization and their art institutions.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Rasu Jalani about his work as an entrepreneur, social sculptor, and cultural curator.
So it'd be great to get some examples of it, but I have a follow-up question of like, do you also look at the things you're funding as a portfolio as opposed to like discrete individual projects?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't even look at it as portfolios. That's the whole thing. Like our director is really conscious about breaking status quo and breaking like even traditional philanthropic vernacular. Right.
Good.
So,
right.
So one of the things we think about is the folks that we fund are grantee partners. We see ourselves in partnership with them because oftentimes what you'll see is like fill in the blank philanthropic organization will fund a project or fund an organization and then attempt to take all the credit for that project or organization's success. What we do instead is like, it's a very tricky thing to navigate, but what we do is like really fund folks who are in relationship to the bigger vision of justice as an institutional practice, how they engage with their staff, board, and community, how what justice issues are coming to the forefront that impacts the landscape that they're in, New York, New Orleans, and Nairobi, and other things. But those are just some like real like pointed ideas that we are attempting to be in alignment with. I think another thing that we've been, and where my role has come in, is as a network curator, how do you bring these organizations together with a common vision around shared resources, shared ideas, very similar
like
to
you
New
said,
Inc.
The collective. You're collective, about a collective.
Very similar right. to what the predication right. on New Inc. was, but like right. you're doing this with organizations, right?
And but do you and work with like several organizations at once or together?
No, we work
or?
With Brick.
Right.
You know, we work with Brooklyn Museum. We work with Ashe Center in New Orleans. You know, we work with the Go Down Center in Nairobi. These are like cultural institutions who are not only tapped into what's happening on the ground and what's happening in their local community, but also informing and pushing it forward, right? So if you're informing and pushing it forward, how are you making sure that you're not repeating some of the negative tropes and the negative ideas and the negative practices that actually extract and make these communities weaker?
This right. is very thoughtful.
Right. So like right. that's kind of, right. and these are my own words. This is not.
No, I can see it's
yeah,
coming
this
from
is
you.
Like literally from my heart. Like that's yes. the way I see it. And and it's been a tremendous practice. It's been, you know, elevating my practice right. into an institutional one.
I have a question, though. You talked about organizations and how they engage with staff and board. How do you research that? Meaning, how do you get deep enough to get into how the board engages?
Relationships.
So you just... Okay.
It's relationships. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, for us to find an organization and not be in relationship with them, is that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, if I personally, Rasu Jalani, am giving money to... I'm sitting on a board of an organization or I decided to fund an organization, I want to make sure that money is not contributing to something that's against my values. I'll make sure of that, right? I'm going to ask a couple of questions. I already have in my mind who I'm considering based off of what I've seen, what I've engaged with, the relationship that we have, the practice that they have. So I'm already having in my mind, I may narrow it down when it comes to Giving Tuesday, but I'm not arbitrarily giving money to projects and people that are not aligned with my values.
When we first met, we had a conversation around grassroots artists in Brooklyn. I don't know if you remember. And talk to us about what you see their needs as being.
I'll just say and not to be glib, but I cannot speak for all grassroots artists, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to say, but what I've been observing, number one thing is rent.
Okay, there you go.
You right. know,
it's
like,
real.
Let's keep it real.
This
like,
is real.
Yeah, I can go, I can get all hunky-dory around like, you know, yeah, they need, you know, this and that, and they need the right partners. Yeah, all of that is true. But when it comes down to it, a lot of folks in New York City is becoming, you know, a place of privilege only, right? Mm-hmm. Like where it's becoming so expensive and so unreasonable. Just, yo, can you give us rent relief? Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of organizations, I think it was USA Artists, galvanized an artist relief fund just for artists to live during the pandemic because they weren't making work.
So you wouldn't necessarily fund artists directly. You would fund a foundation that say would
organizations.
Work with...
Yeah, we do not fund artists directly.
Okay. Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But it also sounds like that most of the... Again, like I say, so it's... So, for example, an organization that wanted to work with policy or the government or whatever is... And do rent relief of some kind, you would fund a project like that.
We don't fund artists. We fund institutions in practice with artists. And we mostly fund general operating. And although
you fund general operating, that
this
makes
is what
you
I'm
extremely
saying.
Unique.
So like, so getting away from the projects and getting away from like, I'm going to create more work to get more money. Right. So one of the things I want to just say out loud for working in institutions for this, for as many years as I have, whether it's Columbia Law School or, you know, MAP International or New Museum or whatever, is that not necessarily these institutions, but just institutions in general can create projects in order to get funding.
Right. That's great. Yeah.
And it's a malpractice, to be honest, right? But, you know, beyond that, you know, if you can't literally feed your staff and all your funding is going to the project, then that's an unsustainable model.
Yeah, which is very unique because, and it's always a mystery to me that why funders don't do things like operations or equipment or stuff that all has to be consumable. It's like, yeah, but that's like only part of the equation.
Yeah. So
well,
we fund the heartbeat.
Yeah, there's strategic interest there too, though. Some funders want to get their message out there. So you got to create that win-win.
So it goes back to what I said a little earlier about like the extraction model of like, applauding yourself for the projects that you funded, like taking credit for the organization's work. Mm-hmm. So the GOS aspect, my opinion, not the organizational opinion, allows for that elasticity where, you know, the organization can just kind of do what they do best and not have to create more projects and more work and, you know.
Mm-hmm. You and I go back a ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we did, there's one of the wonderful parts about New Ink Experience is that they'd have a retreat for several days at Garrison. Mm-hmm. The thing is that you and I had a session with, we paired up together.
Yeah. I do remember. How can I forget that?
What happened?
It was a workshop and it was really about mindfulness. And what I realized years later, that it was really an exercise of compassion. And I don't remember exactly the details of the exercise, but I remember you and I were paired up.
Yeah.
We had to like stare at each other or something.
That must have been awkward.
At one level, it's heebie-jeebie, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it was like, how do you communicate without words, right? How do you read another person's body language?
Or feel their energy.
Right.
How do you read their energy?
True mindfulness. So this circles all the way back to critical consciousness again, right? If we are conscious, then when there's a responsibility to that consciousness, right? That's one. Two, we have to be critical and we have to be able to self-examine and be introspective while in that vibration of consciousness.
Absolutely.
So that's what that exercise was to a degree. It was like, how are you examining what's happening and being with it at the same time?
We have to wrap up, right?
Yes, and I guess I'm going to have to say namaste. But anyway, this was fascinating, Rasu.
Yeah.
We want to have you back. So thank you so much. And thank you so much for the work that you are doing with the Lambent Foundation and the work you've done previously.
Thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.